It's not even about who can vote. It's who does vote. These are the policies that are going to please this group, and so I can easily get all of that group's votes, or close enough.
Human beings love talking about themselves more than anything.
Identity politics removes the strength from diversity.
Philosophers.
Philosophers.
All right, David, what are we talking about today?
Well, now that we have finished last week livening the mood by talking about holidays, back to reality, we're going to talk about politics.
Which hopefully, by the time you're hearing this, you will have already got done hearing about all the politics from your family that you saw over the holidays.
Yes.
Keeping with the theme.
So this week, we're going to talk about why we all hate each other.
Cool.
So we have a thesis for today's episode, which is that all democracies, or at least representative democracies, function by identity politics. Identity politics is a core feature of representative democracy.
Yep. All right.
Not by design.
I don't think
the people who came up with the idea of representative democracy hoped that this would happen. I think that this is like just an inevitable place where the incentives take it.
Maybe. I'm not a political historian, but I feel like it's just so ingrained in it that if you look at how democracy has been implemented, it is almost always initially restrictive in who gets a voice and representation.
That is true.
And they're usually done by specific groups that want to, that are watering down, or that are essentially restricting the pool of groups so that they will always be a majority initially. It's very oligarchic almost.
That is true. I don't know. I feel like that's just kind of like an incidental thing. Okay, let's get where we're going here. So the argument goes that in a representative democracy, of course, the representatives need votes in order to gain office. So the easiest strategy for getting votes is to appeal to certain demographics, which we can also call identity groups.
Mm-hmm.
And in so doing, it means that they sort of stray from what should in principle be their goal, which is representing their congressional district, right? We're talking about the federal government, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
They should be interested in representing the interests of their congressional district, but instead they end up representing only those who fall into the identity groups that they appealed to during voting, or during the election cycle, I mean, their campaign. So that being the case, the only thing that the politicians actually care about are these identity groups, and therefore all democracies function by identity politics.
Yeah. And, you know, it almost serves as a, and I think what's interesting about this is that there's a concept in most democracies that because they function by geographic means most of the time, right? Mm-hmm. The concept of gerrymandering often gets talked about in one way, which is that, oh, they're spreading out their geographic area of coverage to get just the smallest majority that they would need to hold and then share that majority out with other members of their party, right? Like the controlling party that does the gerrymandering wants to...
Right. Redraw the district borders so that
your group is...
Is a slim majority in as many districts as possible.
Right. But this is literally to alter the fact that people of a particular geographic area tend to, not always, represent a coalition of identity groups that are brought about in a party, especially in the United States, mm-hmm. where you get two choices, which is a consequence of first past the poll voting. You essentially right. get two parties.
which is a completely different topic. And go watch CGP Gray's multiple videos about voting systems. Yep. They're great.
They're great. But you can also see other parties that would benefit from this. So, for example, in a country like the United States that has a two-party system, that doesn't mean that there aren't just that there are just two parties. There's two that matter, but there are third parties. And what interestingly ends up happening is that parties that are in control don't care about the third parties. And so you can end up with districts that are actually created purely based on some identity that end up inadvertently favoring the third party as well, mm-hmm. whereas they normally wouldn't have been favored, which is interesting. But you're right. Like, on paper, you look at this and go, yeah, well, it makes sense. People who live in an area who are forming a society together, right, to be represented at a higher level, we need to make sure that the person representing them speaks for everyone in that group.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you turn around and you look at politicians and the way national political parties are constructed, they're chasing identity groups and trying to get a sum total vote and then using gerrymandering to kind of clean it up.
Right, because it's a lot harder to just have a set of very agreeable opinions than it is to just make campaign promises that appeal to, for instance, immigrants or some other demographic like that, right? I'm just going to make promises that will fit, or the elderly, or whatever demographic
or
you want.
Or some race, because that's another big one.
That's another big one. Or women, or whatever. Any group, any identifiable group that can vote,
mm-hmm.
is an option for you to target in your campaign promises. Which is, by the way, why nobody cares about children, because they can't vote.
Same thing with, it's not even about who can vote. It's who does vote.
Right.
Good. I think the best example I ever saw was people, because being a young lad myself at one point, as a former baby, I'm just kidding. but I remember being in college and hearing people talk about how, well, I'm going to vote for Bernie Sanders because he's going to get rid of student loan debt. That was like one of the big promises mm-hmm. back in the day. And I said, well, he's never going to win. It's like, because y'all aren't actually going to go vote. Like, I know you. I know I've seen you actually show up to class maybe once. So no, you're not actually going to go vote. And the reason I know that is because we are one of the largest voting blocks there is, because populations tend to narrow as you get older because, you know, death occurs.
A pyramid. Yeah.
It's a pyramid scheme. No. if you really want a student loan debt to go away, it would be actually pretty straightforward to do. So it's not about who can vote. It's about who does vote
mm-hmm.
historically and in current, you know. I do think we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves. It might be beneficial to talk a little bit about what identity politics is, because that's a phrase that gets thrown around.
Okay, fair enough.
Quite a bit. And while I think that in the layman definition that most people would take it to mean, it works just fine, I think it would be proper to at least talk about it. So I'm going to read the first paragraph from Wikipedia about it, so that way we can kind of set the stage with that.
Okay.
Well, most of it. I don't care about naming off particular philosophers who come up with this term, but... okay, so, quote, identity politics... politics. Yep.
Right.
Quote, identity politics is politics based on a particular identity, wow, such as race, nationality, religion, gender, sexual orientation, social background, caste, and social class. The term could also encompass other social phenomena which are not commonly understood as exemplifying identity politics, such as the governmental migration policy that regulates mobility based on identities, or far-right nationalist agenda of exclusion of national or ethnic others, so on and so on. So it literally, by definition, is loose. It's any group of people you can put together where some part of how they would identify themselves is the common factor in them voting a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
The notable missing exception here is policy. It actually doesn't matter what policy, like, for example, you would not call the Second Amendment advocates an identity group, because
no,
liking the Second Amendment,
because that's an opinion, not an identity. Yeah.
I Okay, that makes me want to go down
the lines there, but
yeah, that makes me want to kind of go down a rabbit hole a little bit, because what is an opinion other than just an interpretation of something, like a subjective interpretation? So I do think some identities are taken pretty heavy on the subjective tense.
Sure, yeah, but like it is easier in principle to sway your opinion about the Second Amendment versus change one of these other identities about you.
I mean, for now, but we can maybe get into that at some point.
It is easier to, for instance, change your mind about the Second Amendment than it is to change your social class.
True. Actually, no, it's really easy to change your social class one way.
That's true. Yeah. We could go one direction. That, yes.
I have become poor, haver of no money. But yeah. And so that's, I guess, the big difference. And more importantly, I think the phrase that goes along with identity politics a lot, at least that I've heard, is that politics is personal. And it's because it has to do with your identity. Like, that's kind of the slogan, I think, that goes along with identity politics, is that politics is personal. Or at least that's what I've heard. Maybe not others, but that's the way I kind of think about it.
Okay.
Because it's not that you're wanting to make it personal. It's that once it becomes about identity, it becomes personal. It's like it's a knock-on effect that you can't really shake, mm-hmm. I think. So, yeah. By the nature that politicians appeal to groups, like, for example, I think if anyone who listens to others talk about specifically American politics, you'll hear often like the Hispanic vote. Like, mm-hmm. that's a thing that gets talked about a lot because it's questionable.
Yeah, there's only one of those, by the way. So the language would have you believe.
Right. But the attitude is like, okay, but which party gets that vote?
Right.
Or the majority of that votes. And that's one that it's like, well, it depends. And you can also just drill down endlessly. Because what do you mean by Hispanic vote? The Cuban vote and the Mexican vote and the Honduran vote? Like, are we talking first generation, second, third generation? Like, you can fracture these groups endlessly. But politicians, when they're running, politicians don't have to be very smart to have their jobs. They need to be popular. And it's easier to just have rhetoric that appeals to that particular group. Mm-hmm. And this is why you'll see politicians go out speaking Spanish, for example, mm-hmm. at an event. This is purely a pandering move to pander to a particular segment of the population. You know,
in more. Look, I know your language. I'm just like you.
Look, my last name also ends in a vowel. See?
Wow.
I'm just saying, like, you know, that's why this happens. And it's easy to market to. I mean, it's a page right out of the marketing handbook, which weirdly enforces stereotypes as well, mm-hmm. which is something that politicians also seem to be very cognizant of trying to avoid. But
except when
they don't. And you're Donald Trump and you have a taco on Mexico Appreciation Day and you thumbs up Instagram post that thing, you know, or whatever.
Bonus points if it's from Taco Bell.
Bonus points. I feel like the thesis is not particularly hard to defend. I feel like it's fairly obvious. I think maybe I feel like it's pretty obvious that this is just a thing that happens, but
yes.
I don't want to just assume that, like, well, I'm right because I'm saying it and it's me and I'm right, you know? Mm-hmm. But I feel like it kind of just has to be this way as a function of simplicity.
So perhaps we can move on then.
I was going to say,
okay,
because what other alternatives could there be, right? Like, obviously the one that everyone likes to think of is that, oh, well, you know, your small geographic area tends to want to live life a certain way with a certain set of policies. And so you want to make sure that your representative is, like, ideally some aggregated platform of a politician should be the geographic area that they're representing. Right.
Right.
Ideally. Like, that's
but ideally it should be policy based, right? Like, these are just the policies that make sense for the area, right? As opposed to, these are the policies that are going to please this group, and so I can easily get all of that group's votes or close enough.
Well, and also, ideally, it wouldn't, you know, because we're talking about the level up, right? So, like, the person who goes from, you know, Texas's first district, which I don't actually know where that is, so forgive me, for the sake of the argument, the people of Dallas and the Dallas-Fort Worth area, I'm going to use that, that's probably not their first district, but it doesn't matter. There's a person who gets elected from that area to go sits in Congress in D.C., right? Ideally, you know, that person would come from that area and say, okay, we've already figured out how we want to conduct ourselves, because I'm not setting laws for here that are just for here. That's already happened. There are local assemblies, cities, counties that do these things, states even that do these things, right? So ideally, I'm only going to talk about things that aren't going to specifically address this area, but if they were to have an effect, if it would be a positive effect that these people would like, I would advocate for it. If it's a policy that would positively impact the citizens of my area, I would thumbs it up and agree. Or if I think my people would like it. Or if it's something that would negatively affect this area, I'm going to advocate against it. You know what I mean? Ideally, that's what you would want, is it's policy-based in the terms of like, well, we tend to live life this way and we like it and we think it's right. Otherwise, we wouldn't be doing it. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go to the federal level and advocate something similar. Or I'm going to compete with my district's interests against all the other districts' interests so that the only things they get through are things that are in a majority of our interests.
Right. For all the districts. Yeah.
Ideally. Correct.
Yes. That's ideally how it should work. Yes.
Right. But that's not how it works.
No.
At all. So you might say that that's what the point is, but it's not.
Well, but so I think, yeah, I think that the place, I mean, the reason why this becomes a problem though, is because since the politicians in their campaigns divide us all up into teams like this, then they basically, they're willing to promise things to benefit one demographic over another, even within the same district, right?
Mm-hmm.
They pick favorites. And so that's what I meant at the beginning of the episode when I said we're going to talk about why we all hate each other. It's because we are basically just forced to pick sides and only vote in our own personal interest rather than the interest of the district.
Right.
Personal interest in terms of our identity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. So, like, the student demographic you were talking about earlier, people with lots of student debt.
Mm-hmm.
If they would get out and vote, it would be in their personal interest to forgive themselves of the debt, essentially.
Right.
At the expense of all the other taxpayers, right?
Or, whoever is issuing the debt.
Rather than us all deciding what makes sense if we want to use this money or not for a better society, right? Which is presumably what the point of student loans is society giving a loan to people so that they can become productive members of society.
Which, right? Supposedly they would be able to pay back if they made good choices, which I'm already getting into the issue, which is not the point.
Which is not the point.
Yeah.
But rather than talking about, the real conversation about something like that should be about, like, okay, what should the interest rates be? What should the terms of repayment be so we can make sure that it is possible for them to be paid back, right? And, you know, what should maybe be the barriers to entry so that people have to have some level of responsibility in order to do this, rather than getting a useless degree or not getting a degree at all, and getting out of school with lots of debt, things like that. Like, actually talking about the problem rather than, we should just forgive all the debt because I'm in debt and that would really help me out if I just didn't have to pay that back. And the other side going, hey, I loaned you that as a taxpayer and you need to pay it back. Otherwise, you're costing me money unfairly.
Right. Yeah. And I also think maybe that's another thing that comes about this is, why is this even a thing that's being discussed? Well, like, why is this particular issue one that was like a group, an identity that got put out there,
yeah,
you know? Well, I think it also has to do with the fact that how is the government structured? Like, where is the power dynamic laid out, right? So, and again, simplicity. It's so much easier. Like, you see this a lot in the United States. Everyone cares about the presidential election because it's usually one or two. It's usually two people. There's two people you need to care about, and you're picking from two options.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a whole process that takes over a year to narrow it to those two people that practically no one's involved in, but complains about constantly, even though they're not, well, one of the parties you're not barred from entering to actually just control that to some degree. The other, you have some control, but not total control, right? And also, that's where the money is. Like, so much money is aggregated at one level because everyone cares about it. That's how you have to solve this problem. Because the state of California could decide to forgive all Californian debt on student loans. They could just decide to do that. Mm-hmm. There's nothing preventing that. The city of Los Angeles could decide to do that. There's no reason that federal government has to be the one to figure it out. Because the function's essentially the same. There's money owed that is just not going to be owed anymore, either by paying it off one way or the other. Like, spoiler alert. Yeah,
the question is, which pool does the money come from, I guess? Where, you know, whether it's the city of Los Angeles or the state of California or the U.S. Treasury. Yeah.
Right. And so, because it's not that the, well, I say that. Arguably, well, there's a big question. That's a good question. You know, I don't want to go too far down this, but I'm not going to go into it. It's not the point, because I was getting
into it. Not what the episode is about. Yeah.
It's not what the episode is about. Yeah. So, but also, when you look at the percentage of the population in each spread geographic area that are students with debt, they're actually pretty spread out. But in their local areas, they're a pretty small percentage of the population, but as a total percent, they're larger. So their voice on the national stage is higher because they are a big group spread thinly. Mm-hmm. So I think what you end up with is you can play either game. It just depends. Like, if you're the state of California, you hold a lot of sway because you have the most seats in the House, right? Theoretically. Or if you live in a small town, you as an individual have a lot of say because your vote counts for more. But if you're looking at the federal level, you know, like it, if you're, you know, I think policy tends to be more something concerned when your vote matters more directly in a small area. But when you're just one fish in the middle and you're spread thinly in a federalized system, it just makes sense to go to that level. And I think this is why you see, I think, identity politics percolate the most at the federal level, or at the meta federal level, where you get into this weird zone of like how money gets moved around. That's another weird thing to think about is, you know, there are politicians, the politicians' main jobs are getting donations. That's their primary job, is collecting money for doing nothing, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Like donations. Don't get me wrong, they do things for it, but still, they take donations. But they don't get to keep it, you know? Like, I think a good aside here was talking about, like where how does the Speaker of the House get picked? Because ideally, it's just, okay, nominations go out, then the whole group votes on one person and says, okay, this is the most popular person in the House. But how does a person actually get nominated and put out? Well, historically, it's whoever the best donor collector is, whoever gets the most donations, because those donations are getting spread to everybody else.
Right, because they're a party.
Because they're a party, exactly.
Yeah, they're not all just individuals, yeah. Mm-hmm. They have their own coalition.
Exactly.
Which shares money, yeah.
Which shares money. And so, but also to be a part of the coalition and to be sharing money, that's a lot more easy if you all kind of have a set of identities that, again, are also spreading across all of the geographical area to have that money moved around to. So, I don't know. I feel like there's a function where, like, maybe you can see the ideal form of democracy at a small enough level. But the moment where I think the moment where you're not able to actually physically go see the politician who's making the decision, like, if you are not capable of doing that easily, or you can't just get enough people together as an individual, if you cannot rally enough support just going door to door and getting that support to get something changed and it actually maybe have an outcome, the moment that becomes unattainable, identity politics is preferred, especially in the era of the internet, where we already kind of pre-sort ourselves by our identities as well. Like, there are groups, you know, forums, chat rooms, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, we sort ourselves into our own interests, yeah.
Exactly. So it's just much easier to have that happen. Yeah,
because I'm not gonna find it interesting to spend time in a forum that whose topic is stuff I don't care about.
Well, and if there's one thing we know, human beings love talking about themselves more than anything.
Yes.
So they're going to go find things that align with their identity, which is themselves. And that's a one way where they can talk about other people while also talking about themselves, mm-hmm. you know? So I think that's the ideal alternative, but I just don't think it's feasible outside of, you know, very small groups, which weirdly, why is that a I guess a quick tangent on this. I feel like that's how most governmental systems end up being, right? Like you ask anyone about their system and they're like, well, it works great at this level. Like communism works great when there's 20 people in the commune.
Mm-hmm.
Well, TM. So communists will say, like,
yeah,
because that's how most communists live out their communist fantasy, is actually joining a commune of like 20 or 30 people where you can actually just resolve disagreements in person to person,
mm-hmm.
right? Where if you were to make some kind of policy like, oh, we're actually going to force someone to go down and work in the spice mines, you'd have to look that person in the face and tell them you're going to go work in the spice mines, or you would see the person who would make them do that,
mm-hmm.
right? And you don't feel good about that, so you don't do it. Like, there's more humanity in that,
yeah.
you know? I was wondering why that is. Like, why is it that... Like, what is the problem with the economies of scale when it comes to government, it seems? You know? Because I feel like any government falls apart when it gets far enough away from the people it's supposed to govern.
Well, yeah, I think it's that there is a fundamental limit on the number of relationships that a person can manage in their own head, right?
Mm-hmm.
All of the interpersonal dealings break down when you're dealing with people with whom you have no real social relationship to that you can comprehend, right? You do have a real relationship to everyone else in your society and maybe even people outside your society. But you don't actually know those people though. And so the relationship you have to them is transparent to you. You don't really see it.
No.
And so to try to get a grip on, okay, how am I going to convince, you know, however many 100,000 people I have to in my congressional district to vote for me, you have to strategize, right?
Yeah.
How can I break a problem with 500,000 steps into a problem with much fewer steps?
Mm-hmm. Also, I mean, I think... As a function of law and particularly taxes, I think taxes are the most telling place where this happens,
mm-hmm.
Especially in the United States, but I imagine it's the same everywhere else because it's just how it works. Most tax codes are only like a page. They're not very big. Well, sorry. That what the tax is pretty short.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what is the income tax rate? Well, it's this chart. It's pretty straightforward. It's about a page. Now, the other 999 pages are... exemptions to that first page.
Yes. Which are all forged by, yeah, it's a list of kickbacks. Yeah.
Literally, yes.
Yeah.
And they're almost entirely...
Vote for me, and we'll make this chart a little easier for you. Yeah.
Right. I think the biggest one, and CGP Gray is the one that brought this up, like, countries where agriculture is a big deal, that there are agricultural kickbacks for mm-hmm. that. Like, where the majority of the people are farmers or farm-related, well, those people vote. You know, and they can vote as a group. And you can make, with one stroke of a pen, you can say, I'm actually going to cut taxes by 5%.
For farmers.
And now all of a sudden, you have a massive segment of the population that just instantly supports you. Like, oh, good, you're our man, you know. We want to make things easier by supporting a program to help out Latinos. Cool. Well, if you're in South Texas or Florida, you just got wickedly popular.
Mm-hmm.
Because there happens to be a lot of people that demographic there, you know? So in a weird way, these politicians are kind of doing what they're supposed to do, because why would you as a politician support something that doesn't actually help you? Like, if you're a politician, if you're like a Democrat from Michigan, there's no real reason for you to support, you know, lower taxes on migrant workers, because most of them don't go that far.
Mm-hmm.
And they're definitely not voting, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's also kind of a free-for-all where you'll let it happen, though, as long as you get your thing in. That's another thing that tends to happen, is that you see these omnibus packages where it's like, well, look, we're not all going to agree on what we're going to put, so we're just going to close our eyes and just write our wish lists, and then we're just going to make everybody happy. Even though you end up with this like massive thing, you know, of all the groups fighting over their piece. And you kind of get to this weird point where I feel like if the exemptions list gets long enough, it's like you realize that, well, who's left? Who's not fitting any of these exemptions? And it's kind of like the whole, if everybody's special, no one is kind of thing, where it's like, you know, we could have just...
And now we're right back where we started, and we could just rip all these pages out and follow the chart.
Which is kind of funny, because whenever someone goes up to say, hey, what's your platform? I'm going to cut taxes. Everyone is like, great, but half the people freak out about the economy and how, oh, the government's not going to make any money. But then they cut taxes, and wait a minute, why did tax revenue not go down? It's like, oh, because that tax cut only happened for a very tiny percentage of the population who wasn't one of these exemptions. So it's like, you didn't actually do much, you know? So yeah, I don't know. so dumb. Like, it's frustrating, honestly, to think about. But I wonder, cause I guess the natural goings on from here, like the thesis of saying that all democracies are fundamentally become identity politics. Is that a bad thing or a good thing?
It's a bad thing.
Okay, so we spent the first 30 minutes talking about what it is, but I guess we've been alluding to the fact that it's a bad thing. But David, why is it a bad thing? Because at the end of the day, people are getting what they want.
Well, except that they're not. That's all well and good that you can get your one thing, but you're also up against all the other demographics who have interests that are against yours. And so the problem is that you have politicians who are aligning, well, who obviously are going to align only to those who vote for them. That, like, ultimately, that's where it goes. Like, okay, my example that I have been thinking about this week is political campaigns, like action campaigns. Hey, the House of Representatives has introduced this bill. This bill is bad for reasons, right?
Fair enough.
We should all write to and or call our congressional representatives and tell them why we oppose this bill. Seems like a good idea. Problem. Your congressional representative does not care.
No.
And the reason they don't care is because you fall into one of two demographics: people who voted for them and people who didn't. If you didn't vote for them, why do they care about your opinion in the first place, right? You're not the one who gets them in office, and you're not going to get them in office next time either. So why do they care about pleasing you?
Right.
And if you did vote for them, they already got what they wanted out of you, and you're probably going to do it again. Because they're still going to appeal to your demographic, right?
And you have the right letter by your name.
Yeah. So literally, all those letters can go in the trash. I'm going to hire an intern to answer the phone and not care about anything that you say, and maybe even write it down and then throw it in the trash. And that's going to be the end of it. And then none of them care. They're just going to do their thing. They're going to listen to the people who are actually paying the bills. And that's who runs the country.
Yeah.
That's why it's bad.
That is why it's bad. Well, and, you know,
among other reasons, but that's
among other reasons, but realistically too, these identity groups, I mean, I think it's funny because people who are very open about being a, because I think there's also, I've noticed there are people that are just wholesale acknowledge that they're voting as a part of an identity group, right? They're just like, yes, this is how we should be doing things, because this is how we protect my identity or whatever. And then there are people who deny it. Democrats and Republicans, frankly, you know, for the most part. Although you do see it on both sides, just one's more honest about it.
Yeah. I was going to reduce that to, yeah, there's two people. People who know they're, people who openly admit to voting because of their identity, and liars.
Yeah. but still, the people who are open about their identity politics also usually hate, well, I guess anybody who's acknowledged and acting as a part of an identity group, they hate lobbyists, because this is an individual that represents a non-identity, because companies aren't identities, or financial groups are not necessarily, financial interests are not identities. They're just things.
Yeah.
They could be identities. It depends.
They're coalitions.
They're coalitions too. But when you look at how they end up actually doing this, well, pick your identity of choice. There's a charity or a political action committee that's built around that identity, which spends money doing, guess what?
Lobbying.
Yeah. It's just a more efficient way to lobby and collect money from, to source a larger pool of money from a larger group of people, which even then, though, if you go break down how they're getting donations, it's still just a handful of donors. Like 80% of the funds going through into campaign donations come from 20% of the people. Like this still happens just in the name of something else, but you're okay with it because it has your identity attached to it. So in a weird way, I feel like identity groups also serve as nice covers for lobbying efforts, which I think most people universally agree is a bad thing. Because wait, why are you listening to them just because they're money?
Yeah.
Because of course.
That's the answer to all the questions. Yeah.
Like I was talking to someone a while ago about how I thought that the City of London, which this CBGB Grey has a great video on, by the way, it has a weird type of democracy where companies get to vote. Like, they don't literally get to vote, the board, but they get to pick employees to go vote, which may or may not be members of the board. But the reason they do is because the majority of the population that is in that part of the city don't live there, but they go there for work.
Right.
And so it's gotten to the point where you living here doesn't actually matter as much necessarily as...
Well, yeah, it's like a business district anyway, right?
Exactly. Now, don't get me wrong.
People, so the business is what matters, yeah.
Yeah, even though some people do still live there and they do get to vote, but it's not fair to just let this small minority of people who are... And they're
who happen to live inside this arbitrary border...
Right.
...to get to control everything that happens there because... There's way more people who are actually doing stuff there every day.
Yeah. You're only the majority at night.
Yeah.
During the day, though, you are a vast minority. And so to balance it out, let's give these people some of the vote. One of the things that I found to be very interesting about that, and I kind of like, is that, well, it's proportional, though, to the influence of how the area actually functions. Mm-hmm. Because, you know... If you roll back democracy to how it got started, at least in the United States, and in most places this is the case, but I'm going to use the U.S. example because I'm taught that history. We had a representative democracy starting out of a certain group of people.
Mm-hmm.
There were three particular criteria you had to meet.
White landowning men.
That's right. So... There are, of those three things, we've done a pretty good job of eroding away two of them, and it gets talked about a lot. Mm-hmm. So, the white part, which was the first one that got addressed, funnily enough. Yeah,
hilariously. Yeah.
Yeah, that's not great. Okay, fine. If people of other races can also vote, and there are, that is a big story in our national lineage.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there is a constitutional amendment that everyone, well, I'd hope everyone knows, the 13th, that talks about that. Oh, you're people now. Well, you're voting, your men are people now, so you can vote.
That's not the 13th, I don't think.
Yeah,
13th is emancipation. Yeah, you can't be slaves anymore.
Well, is it the 14th then? Like 13, 14, 15 all came back to back to back.
I think it is the 14th, yeah.
Sure, so 14th then. You're people, and almost immediately... Being people, well, the men of you are now people, and you also now get to vote.
You can vote because you're men. Yeah,
right. That was really quick, but still, it's seen as a big victory, and it is, to be fair, a big victory in our march towards representation, which is a big deal. Okay, cool. Well, the next big one was women. Turns out they get to be people too, and get to vote. Awesome. But you don't hear the whole property one get mentioned very often.
Nope.
Why? Why is that just glossed over? Because in my mind, of the three specific limitations that were given, the first two, it makes total sense to open up. Like, those were bad ideas that were really just kind of based on, is it really a good idea to give those people power?
Yeah. It's based on prejudice. Yeah.
But I think the last one actually had a good point. There was a good reason, I think, that one existed.
Mm-hmm.
And that being that for the same reason that we vote based on a geographical basis. You actually own a part of the country. And in America, that's how it was. You could actually own the dirt in a physical place, right? So right. By buying a piece of land, you have
stake in the country.
Literally, you have staked a claim in the country. So it made sense that you should get a say in the policies that affect the place where your physical stake is. Because you can get up and move, but you can't take the land with you. Mm-hmm. That's always going to be governed by the government. You can leave, you can go west, right? Mm-hmm. Back in the day, you could go west and say, screw it, I'm going to go do things out there and not be governed. But you can't take the land in Massachusetts with you. West. Right. That's always going to be governed.
Yeah.
And the limits of governance are usually also geographical. Where does the American law, where does the law of the United States of America stop being in effect?
Outside its borders.
Outside its borders. So it makes sense, right? So that's the one where I'm kind of like, when did that one stop being a thing? And why, we don't talk about that one enough, I think.
No.
Like, and don't be wrong, I can see through the layers of it of like, well, that disenfranchises poor people. And I'm like, that's true. But, you know, like, it's not just the land, too. There's also this idea that, well, by having the land, you're going to care about it. And you caring about it means you're going to invest in it.
You have something to lose. That's the thing.
Yeah. You know, and it goes on from there. So it's like, I don't know how I got on this tangent necessarily, but I guess that's also not necessarily an identity group, whereas the other two definitely are.
Right.
Like, you could argue
anyone from any identity group can own property.
Right. It's an opt-in or outable identity group.
Mm-hmm.
If you even can call it an identity group, you can opt in or out of it pretty easily, pretty attainably. Whereas it'd be pretty hard to opt into either of the other groups, you know? And I feel like that's kind of part of it. Like, I feel like if you brought that back, I say that. There is, though, I think a meta identity that goes along with that. That is, in theory at least, by owning land here, you have a vested interest here. Like, you care about this, or you should care about this. That's maybe the meta identity that goes along with that, is that, you know, if a law gets passed that affects anything that you own or where you are, well, the place where you can go to have autonomy, if there's any law that infringes onto that, you should care about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it matters. You know, I don't know. And I feel like, in a weird way, I feel like that would temper out a lot of this other politics, because now it doesn't matter necessarily what your identity is. You know what I mean? Like, it's a lot, because now you're forcing everybody to share that part of the identity to be a part of the voting block. And to be fair, the other two things did that as well, but for bad reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think it's hard to argue that this is a bad reason, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because the other thing that I think is bad about identity politics is that it is inherently divisive. Identities create in-groups and out-groups.
Yeah.
100%. You know? And I feel like those should not matter under governance, but if there was going to be one that mattered, it should be people who hold stake in the country, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because also, by holding stake in the country, your actions and your care of that place directly affect the value of the country, just like it directly affects the value of the land, you know? And then, here we go. Now I can tie it back to the London case. The reason the businesses get the right to vote is their actions and how permissive the government is towards them and how it controls what they're able to do directly affects the value of the city of London.
Mm-hmm.
It's a profitable business district because it's more permissive. And if they were to leave, it would drop the value of the area, thus drop the taxes that can be collected, and it just makes it an inherently less nice place to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and these people are benefiting the area, whereas you just having an identity doesn't inherently benefit an area. Like, I'm sorry, it doesn't. Like, or it shouldn't anyway, I don't think. Like, there are the people out there who are pretty racist, I think that it does. It's like, well, yeah, this area has a lot more value because the whites live here. It's like, whoa, like, that's pretty messed up.
Yeah.
Also, that doesn't pan out, I think, on paper at all. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But, you know, I think you'd be hard-pressed to say that that a particular identity does benefit it without sounding incredibly, you know, phobic of some type,
mm-hmm.
you know. And also, I just don't think it pans out, you know. So, and if you do, it also, that just cranks up more divisiveness because you're now having to cast down an out-group. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, I think that's the real bad part of it, ultimately, is that it takes an in-group, out-group bias and makes that the center of politics as opposed to of who's actually benefiting or not benefiting the nation as a whole
mm-hmm.
by having stake in it, which would incentivize you to benefit it, you know? And I feel like that's obvious, too, like as to why it's bad, right?
Sure.
I mean, how does that square with the whole diversity is our strength, though, mentality or the multicultural dynamic? Do you think? Because I could see some people saying that, no, by having these identity groups represented and empowered, it increases this, which inherently increases the value, right? But that's also a kind of just an opinion.
I think that the presence of diversity is a strength, but that doesn't mean that, like, deciding... Okay, the thing about identity politics is that it pits identities against one another. Rather than thinking about what benefits us all as members of a society, we're thinking about only what benefits those in my identity group. And so in that case, having more identity groups just means there's more competing forces acting against one another. It actually, here's a quotable quote from yours truly. Identity politics removes the strength from diversity. It is counterproductive to the whole ideal of diversity, because it turns diversity into a weakness, because of the division that it creates, as opposed to diverse people coexisting and cooperating.
Yeah. Do you think the geographic nature of at least most democracies, you would think that it would offer kind of a chilling effect to identity politics because you'd have to be a sizable enough identity to overcome that boundary? Or do you think, like, I guess the reason I'm asking is because I could foresee a model, and maybe this would be a thing that would be, well, those who are all contributing as a part of identity politics would be incentivized to try is to remove the geographic barrier from democracy. Like, for example, imagine, well, you can vote for anybody, right? Or you can vote for any party, right? Like, you get a ballot with just all the parties, mm-hmm. and it's national. So you just check for national elections. It's national. So you just check the parties that you want. This party. And then once the votes are all tallied up, the percentage of the winnings of each party that are selected have just pre-select, like the parties get to pick the order of their representatives. Like, well, we definitely want this person and this person and this person and this person.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the top 100. So, okay, cool. We went, our party got 40 seats. So 1 through 40 get to go sit now. And sorry, 60 through 100, we just didn't do as good as we wanted to, right? But that would allow for parties that are really niche, like, oh, I'm for the furry party. Well, there might be enough furries to get, if there's, what is it, like 250,000 people, roughly, I think. Is that how many people it takes to get a rep? Or that's how many people each rep represents, something like that?
And it also varies from place to place, I think, so.
There's a really simple way I think I can figure this out. The adult population of the U.S., in 2023 was nearly, well, this is just the 366 million, but I'm pretty sure. That's
the total population, yeah.
Okay, and about 79% of those were older than 18, so get a calculator out here.
290 million-ish.
Yeah, 290-ish, so 290 divided by, 438 or 538? It's 438, right, because there's 100 in the Senate. I think it's 400.
There's 50 in the Senate. No, there's 100 in the Senate. I'm smart.
Yeah, he was smart.
I have a math degree, I promise.
I'm pretty sure it's 438.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's about 600,000 people.
Okay.
I think. Point being, you know, 600,000 people, if there are more than 600,000 furries, then neat, you get a rep.
You have enough to get a rep.
Congratulations, you get a rep. You know, like
Congressionations,
you get a rep.
Yeah, okay. So what was the question then?
So yeah, if we moved
where politics is purely based on special interests and identities rather than and geography is not one of those.
Right.
What about it?
Like, would that be even worse? Because I could hear people that would be in favor of, you know, the identity politics being okay, wanting to take it to its next logical conclusion, you know, which would be that, right?
Yeah, I think that is worse. And I think, I mean, yeah, okay. So really, the geographic distribution of jurisdiction is a totally separate issue from this, but it's related because, yes, those who are in favor of identity politics in democracy do seem to want to push in that direction.
Well, like things like Napavo Interco are kind of obvious.
Yes.
Which, again,
CGP Grey video.
The triple.
Okay, anyway,
yeah.
The really, really Cliff's Notes on that is a backdoor way to bypass the Electoral College.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, well, not even that, but just people who call for national policies on everything rather than local ones.
Right.
It's that you end up with people who are far away from you making the rules because there's just more people who live there. But why should somebody in some far off city, thousands of miles away from me, be able to decide how I live my life out here when they don't even know me and will probably never interact with me ever?
Right. Well, the obvious answer is federal taxes.
Yeah.
Because that does affect everybody. And yes, the money that's collected by federal taxes is spent ideally on everybody.
Except that it isn't.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that's the thing. But yeah. So people who care about identity politics tend to push for that. But yeah, but I think that the geographic component is very important to, yeah, making sure that rules are relevant to the people upon whom they're imposed. Yeah. The only policies that should be set at a national level are those that do affect us all in the nation. And anything that isn't in scope, anything that isn't in that scope shouldn't be on the table for a federal policy.
Right. Which, I mean, realistically, that should be two things. Like, it could just be as few as two things. It should be foreign policy. Fair enough.
Right.
We're
all part of a nation. We're going to interact with the world as one unit. Yeah.
Yep. And then interstate problems. Like,
right. So that Nebraska and Kansas don't go to war.
Right. And at that point, I think it makes sense for every other state to get to say, A, because it waters down a local issue, it spreads it out to being like, look, if you can't work it out between yourselves, everyone else will work it out for you, and you need to have it, and the federal government needs to have a big enough stick to wag at any state out of line,
mm-hmm,
trying to mess with any other state. But I think realistically, those are the only things that actually need to be cared for by the federal government.
Which, by the way, are the things that are written in the Constitution as the things they're supposed to do.
Yeah, I mean,
almost like they thought about this 250 years ago.
Exactly. Like, what is it? The 10th Amendment that straight up said that if it's not explicitly covered in this document, it goes down to the states to deal with, because yes, that's the point. Mm-hmm. Like, here we are enumerating. You know, that's something that's kind of interesting, because I remember taking civics in high school, and the one thing that was really strongly emphasized was the elastic clause of the Constitution for the Congress. But that was not checked by the 10th Amendment when it was taught to me. So, mm-hmm, unchecked by the 10th Amendment, it sounds a lot like Congress can do whatever it wants, pretty much. Or, mm-hmm, you know, the president can do this. The Supreme Court does literally just this, even though they just gave themselves an authority that they didn't have, but whatever. You know, the executive does this, the judiciary does this, and the representatives do this. And if there's anything that's within the federal scope that's not covered, well, it defaults back to the representatives. But and if you stop there, it makes it seem like, well, yeah, they were supposed to grow their responsibility to other things. But if you roll but back to the 10th Amendment
literally says, no, this is for the states or the people.
Right. Should be very simple.
Yeah. Well, and that's why anytime that the federal Congress does something that gets down into people's lives like that, they justify it with some sort of like interstate commerce related thing, right? We have the ability to regulate this because it affects interstate commerce in some way, because that authority is given to us by the Constitution.
Yeah. And I'm pretty sure that the 10th Amendment to the Constitution has like, it's like one of the least challenged in the Supreme Court level. Like no one uses that as a, maybe I'm wrong about that.
One of the least thought about amendments, not the least, which is the 3rd Amendment, which is definitely not thought about anymore.
Yeah, and I think the one that was, yeah, I'm reading through like one of the only ones, was it was the Brady Bill having to do with firearms. Neat. Anyway, not the point.
Of course.
Of course. I mean, I don't think it comes as a secret to our listeners, but we just inherently don't care for identity politics at all. I think basing policy, like, how should we as a society conduct ourselves and regulate ourselves should have nothing to do with your identity and those you share that identity with necessarily.
Right.
Because
we should hold one another to a common standard.
Exactly. Like if 100% exactly right. It should be the same for everybody. And if we can't agree, it's better to just not agree and then not set a standard that we don't expect to hold everybody to. But we try anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I think it just applying that at a federal level just makes sense too. Obviously, we have problems with democracy because it's inherently like this. And I think this is going to go on my list of things that make democracy bad. Now, that being said, out of other options, I'll take democracy. You know, I would rather a democracy than a monarch any day of the week.
Mm-hmm.
Because at least on paper, I'm supposed to have a say. But how you conduct that democracy, I think, is open for improvement. Which is weird because I feel like no one talks about how democracies can be improved. It's usually just democracies are good and more representation is better. Which is inherently okay. Like, yeah. Like, yeah, if we have a democracy and it's for all adults, then yeah, all adults should vote.
Mm-hmm.
Or be able to. Yeah, makes total sense. Don't see anything wrong with that, you know. But I can't help but think that, in particular, the American democracy is incredibly susceptible to identity politics. But I don't think it's just unique.
I think all democracies are equally susceptible to identity politics, representative ones, I mean. They're equally susceptible to identity politics, but the American representative democracy has succumbed more quickly than the others. But I think it's only a matter of time. And American politics, of course, leaks into every other politics. So,
well, you say that. I feel like it's just the one that fell from that harder because, I mean, parliamentary democracies, a lot of them come from an identity background,
mm-hmm.
i.e. houses of lords and others,
mm-hmm.
you know, or commoners, you know, like those are identity politics.
Sure.
You know, I just feel like as we expanded the right to vote in the United States, it introduced more identity politics, which I think is just inevitable. Like the reason it didn't is because we explicitly excluded certain identities of people, which is, you know.
Well, yeah, we had second class citizens. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Arguably not even citizens really. Like, I guess it depends.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I don't know. Have we talked about better ways? Like, if not democracy, then what else? Or is it, you know, at what point is it, you know, what can you do about it to prevent it from being as much of a thing, I guess?
I think this is a fundamental problem of representative democracy. It's going to go this way eventually. It, just like how first-past-the-post voting systems eventually go to a two-party system.
You think so? I mean, I understand how first-past-the-post gets this way because it's, like, mathematically going to happen.
Yeah. I think this is, like, mathematically going to happen. Yeah.
Hmm.
It's all... Well, because even the mathematical reasons that you... that you're appealing to for first past the post, it all comes down to human psychology.
True.
The problem with first past the post voting systems and all such flawed voting systems is that human psychology makes us think about how others are going to vote.
Mm.
Like that's the fundamental problem of all of those, is that you think you don't even vote for your own interests because you're thinking about a broader strategy. And in the same way, your politicians that are campaigning are not thinking about what is actually in your interest. They are thinking about what's in their interest according to a strategy.
Hmm. It's very true. I don't think this is the last time we're going to talk about this. This might probably come back up later. Because I know we're about at time.
Talking about how to replace democracy and what with is a topic for a different time.
It is. You know, I think the only thing I would leave it with is that, well, at least in America, the thing that was supposed to put the limits on like what the people could even easily vote for was the Constitution. Like, there's a reason that, like, there's a reason that we have two sets of rules. We have the code, which is the law, and then there's the Constitution and its amendments.
Right, which is even more law.
The super law, mm-hmm. Yeah. That it's the greatest and highest law of the land, against which it does not matter. You know, like, a lot of people were really upsetty spaghetti about the whole, like, Roe v. Wade incident getting overturned. And they're like, how can this court just decide this law doesn't work? I'm like, well, that's literally its job. That's literally why the Supreme Court exists, is to check all laws against the mega super big laws. And if it don't check out, then...
it's gone.
It's just gone, you know? It's like, well, cool. Well, how do we get this to be a super mega big law? Well, hard.
Amend the Constitution, which is a lot harder than passing a regular old law.
Right. And I think, you know, we've talked about this before, but I think it comes back to it, is that ideally you need to set up a system that is hard, that is good, like strategically pretty good, but then hard to change, or requires a greater... because I feel like the more people that are required to vote, the greater the coalition needs to be to change it, to the point where I think there's also...
that's true. That's a good point. Yeah. I think your best way probably to combat this is to... well, yeah. And we've talked about this strategy specifically before, of make it difficult to pass laws and easy to repeal them.
Yeah. Because the other problem with identity politics is that it inherently is divisive. Well... if you just set the threshold to making something a law...
yeah, if it requires a 3/4 majority...
it's really hard.
People are going to really have to want it for it to even become a law.
Yeah. Right. You're going to have to set aside your identity politics and work with enough people to get that by. And
if you can't get 3/4 of people to agree to it, maybe it's not that important.
No. But this obviously, I think, has the downside of, if things are not right... so say, for example, it took... well, it did. It took 3/4 of the people... It took more than just half to get the whole 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments mm-hmm. passed, right? So it has to be important enough. And I think that maybe that's a good historical... I'd have to look into it more.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a good historical precedent where, like, even if there is a minority that holds an inadvertently high amount of power over someone else who's being marginalized, it can still come through, you know, and change. And I think there's a good argument to be made that that change, while maybe it did not change as fast as it would have, that's not the point. And as much as terrible as it sounds, it's like you would rather see things that are bad go on longer but get fixed well, and for a good reason.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I actually am curious, because Because I'm starting to wonder, I was like, did that many people, like, right after we fought a war about it, were that ready to just go? Or did it take a little bit longer? I don't know. I'll have to look more into it. I don't want to waste time necessarily right here. Mm-hmm. Or if there's like some shenanigans that happened where it's like, you know, a certain number of the states got their ballots stuffed because anybody who was against it wasn't allowed to vote or hold office.
Or wasn't there.
Right. Well, a little bit of after show thing that we still had an after show. This would probably be a part of it, but like, screw it. We'll just do it. Since this is our last recording of the year, it was ratified on January 31st of 1865.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It was the first of the three Reconstruction Amendments following the Civil War. I don't know that all of it was over. It was fresh over. And I'm pretty sure, I'll have to go back and look at my history, that I don't think that those states were just instantly welcomed back into Congress as they were. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm pretty sure, you know, there were a lot of...
It was an awkward time.
There were a lot of restrictions on who could be voted for at that time. Like, for example, if you were, I think...
That's also why there's a bit in the 14th Amendment about that if you were part of an insurrection against the government, you cannot run for public office. That's in the 14th Amendment.
Yeah.
Wonder who they had in mind when they wrote that bit of the 14th Amendment.
So, let's see. I'm curious. Let's roll it back to 1865. I'm just looking. This gets the thinky bits going. Yeah. So, like, I'm looking across some of them. There were several Confederate states that just were vacant. They just didn't have seats in Congress. In the, what would that have been, the 38th and 39th Congress?
Mm.
There just wasn't anyone sitting there from 1863 to 1867.
Yeah. That makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense as to how that would have just gotten shoved right through that way. It's like,
the only ones who were there were the ones who supported it. Yeah.
Right. So it was enough to just get pushed through. And then even then, if you go back and look, a lot of them had Republicans, because Republicans were the abolitionist party at the time. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these Confederates were Democrats. They're like, it's just Democrat, all the way along. And then all of a sudden, vacant, Republican, and then right back to Democrat after some of the, you know,
mm-hmm.
as soon as things loosened up a little bit. So yeah, it was a weird time. It's a very weird time, for sure.
Anyway.
Yeah. So until next year. Philosophers.
If you like the music in this episode, please check out Jippy on Bandcamp at jippy.bandcamp.com. Philosophers is supported by viewers like you. If there's a topic you'd like us to discuss,
or a topic you'd like to see revisited in the future,
please let us know by contacting us using the methods in the description,
or in the comments below. Thank you for listening.